Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thanks for listening to the podcast from the Early Morning Late Show. So glad you're with me this morning. It is 4 minutes after the hour, and today is Tuesday. And if you're feeling a little confused, maybe it's because you had a day off yesterday, and that felt like a really long weekend, and today should feel like Monday, but it's not. So you might want to double-check your calendar, because you can get messed up pretty easily, and you know how that works, and then you're mad at somebody. Anyway, we have a great second hour coming up. Dr. David Stevens is with us. He's going to be on our studio line in just a minute. So I'm looking forward to our conversation with him. And then Ron Deal is going to be with us later in the hour. And you know how awesome he is. Okay, there was a movie, Peter Rabbit. I think that's, do I have that right, Rebecca? Peter Rabbit, is that the movie? And then they had the argument about the blueberry or the blackberry allergy.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, it caused a big controversy.
It did. Now, this is in Hollywood, right?
Yes. Last I checked.
All right. This is the same group of people who make television shows suggesting that small children changing their sex is perfectly healthy.
Now that you mention it, that seems a little confused, doesn't it?
It does a little. It's a little bit confusing, but their priorities are clear. They've got an agenda, don't they?
Certainly look. The evidence would suggest so.
Yes, yes. All right. The other day, a kid asked me how old I was. Why would kids do that? What's the point?
Kids are full of questions, aren't they, Bill?
Yes. I said, guess. Ooh. All right, here's a happiness tip for you. Never say guess. Never. But, you know, if you say to an adult, guess, they're going to go the other direction. That's the beauty of that.
Right, because there's a sort of
go young.
Mutual agreement.
Yes, yes.
We'll perpetuate the comfortable lie.
Right.
Kids have no such compunction.
That's really true. And I heard that in the UK, apparently one of our favorite fast food restaurants, whose reputation is selling chicken, ran out of chicken. So there you go. There's British stores, about 300 of them, that ran out of the exact product they're best known for selling. We don't have no chicken. We've got extra potatoes, though, if you like them. How does that work?
Because that's what I go to a chicken restaurant for. The potatoes.
It's like when you go to the coffee shop and they go, well, we don't have any dark roast brewed right now. Well, but that's your business. Your business is brewing coffee.
I'm guessing their motto is not be prepared.
Yeah. Anyway. All right. Dr. David Stevens, hopefully, will be with us here in just a minute. We're going to take a very short break. It's 7 minutes after the hour. And we're going to talk medicine with a good doctor. Be back in a minute. Good morning. The big hand is on the eight. So glad you're with me this morning. Dr. David Stevens is from the Christian Medical and Dental Association. And David, I have my first question for you. When you need expert advice, do you just talk to yourself?
No, I've got a lot of colleagues that I can bounce stuff off on. But the worst thing a doctor can do is treat himself because he has a fool for a physician.
Oh, you make me laugh. All right, let's talk about what's going on in San Francisco. Boy, is that messy.
It is.
They want to be the first safe injection site in the U.S.?
Yeah, what's going on is they're saying what we need to do is create facilities where people who use intravenous drugs can inject pre-obtained drugs. You get your heroin somewhere out on the street, but we'll do that under medical supervision so that we reduce the problems of sharing needles, of disposing of needles, of getting hepatitis C and HIV from using other people's needles by doing it in the park, doing it in the restroom, unnecessary deaths on the street. It's this whole harm reduction ideology. This is inevitable. We can't change really what's happening in drug addiction. So let's just try to take some of the harms away.
All right. When I saw some of the pictures, there was a guy in like a hazmat suit practically hosing down the streets because there were so many discarded needles and then human feces and all kinds of stuff that it just made it almost third world. This is San Francisco.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is really a drop in the bucket for the problem. But it goes back to that same technology of, quote, safe sex. You know, well, let's just decrease the consequences versus dealing with the real issues, which is promiscuity and venereal diseases and all sorts of stuff. Let's just decrease the venereal diseases. And then we're going to, you know, help solve this problem. And maybe we can encourage people when they come in to get their injection that they should go get treatment. The trouble with this essentially puts these people in a free fall society. The pillars of drug policy has been prevention. Let's educate children, teenagers, and adults to not use drugs. Secondly, let's have treatment. When we find out people are in this lifestyle, we want to stop that and let's get treatment. Let's get them counseling. Let's get them drugs to help block the effects of these narcotics they're taking, and let's get them off the drugs. And then third, let's attack it at the source and try to prevent those drugs being available. So that's kind of been the three-prong attack. This one kind of says, hey, this is inevitable. We can't control it. So let's control some of the bad effects in these people. And it doesn't deal with people dropping out of school, losing their jobs, being alienated from their families, you know, being victims themselves of crimes or getting these drugs out on the street. Where are they getting the money for that? Are they doing the crimes? Are they being abused on the streets? And it makes them vulnerable to disease and ultimately death. So, but this ideology spreading around the world, spreading here in the U.S., that all we need to do, or the main thing we need to do, is harm reduction.
So, David, have we just medicalized sin? Is that part of the big problem?
Yeah, I think what's happening is this whole concept of let's just deal with it on the surface instead of dealing at it with the root. I can go cut all the weeds in my garden all I want, but they just grow back. Mm-hmm. I have to pull them out by the roots. Mm-hmm. And so as you focus on let's just decrease the harm to individuals of doing this and the messiness of society, what's on the street, what's in the park, seeing people in the alley shooting up. I mean, these are all terrible things, and we don't want them to happen. And I don't want people to be harmed. I mean, as a physician, I take care of people that do things that they shouldn't do, and I deal with the healthcare issues, whether it's smoking or alcohol or you name it. But if that becomes the main ideology of what we're trying to do, instead of preventing, treating, and decreasing the supply of drugs out there, then I think we're heading down the wrong road, and we're going to end up harming a lot more people than we help.
Mm-hmm. I think this will be the last time I'll repeat this story, but a friend of mine had a hip surgery, hip replacement, and I said, did you get some pain medication on the way out of the hospital? And she said, yes. She got some opioids, and I said, well, how many days did you take them? She said, 3. And I said, oh, how many opioids did they give you? She said, I left with a bottle that had 80 in the bottle.
Yeah. Then it's good advice. You know, you give opioids after serious surgery and that type of thing. You should take them as little and as shortly as possible, mm-hmm. the little amount and as shortly as possible. And good physicians do that. You know, I was out flying to California last week and sat down by a lady who was actually going to Las Vegas to be trained as a flight attendant. And we started talking. She said she could tell something was wrong. And I said, are you okay? And she said, I just came from my niece's funeral. She was 22 years old, overdosed on heroin at home, and killed herself, and she just come from the funeral. This is a huge issue, not something that we can play around with and saying, go get your drugs and come here, and we'll help you inject them safely, and we'll have Narcan, which is a drug that reverses the effect of heroin, will help you prevent you from overdosing, and then you can go out and do it again and come back here to, you know, 6 hours later and do it again. That doesn't solve the problem. That essentially harm reduction ideology, I think, is dangerous in the long term to getting people off drugs in this country.
Mm-hmm. David, I do a lot of work with men who are in drug and alcohol rehab, and I'll never forget a guy I met way, way long ago, and he said, I grew up on the south side of Chicago, and in 1970, when I was struggling with alcohol, alcoholism, that word, I didn't even know it. He goes, back then, he said, you were a drunk and you needed to repent.
Hmm.
Like, whoa.
Yeah.
We don't use that kind of language anymore, do we?
We don't. And we should have compassion for these people and be there trying to help them and rescue them. And, you know, Sweden has some of the best numbers on dealing with this type of problems. And what they do is they actually sentence people to treatment. In other words, you're contained and treated to get off your drugs versus this is inevitable and we can't do anything about it, which underlies this other ideology. And they do good treatment and support and all the rest of it, but they force people to go into it. It's not, well, if you want to, it is you're going to be sentenced to go there to make sure it's done. We're going to get you off these drugs. And they've been highly successful with that because these people cannot make good decisions when they're under the influence of narcotics and other drugs.
That's actually very fascinating. I like that. I have a gigantic heart for people in recovery. So, you know, however they get there, I'm thrilled, but I want them to not only get through their alcohol or drug addiction, but also to come to know the love of Jesus.
Absolutely, and that's the thing that makes the biggest difference.
Yes, apart from that, you got nothing.
Yeah.
All right, David, let me take a break. When I come back, I'd like to continue this conversation, and I want to ask you about physician-assisted suicide and how that is progressing in our country and around the world. It's 16 minutes after the hour. My guest, Dr. David Stevens from the Christian Medical and Dental Association. Welcome back to the program. It's 18 minutes after the hour. Happy Tuesday. I need to remind you, it's not Monday, especially if you had the day off yesterday. I'm speaking to Dr. David Stevens from the Christian Medical and Dental Association. And David, help me out with some of the issues surrounding physician-assisted suicide right now.
Well, I was just last week in California. We've actually, our organization, one of our branches called the American Academy of Medical Ethics, we sued the California government over how they legalized physician-assisted suicide. So last week I was out and did a five-hour deposition with their deputy attorney general on this issue. And essentially the points we made, there's a lot of points to make about physician-assisted suicide, is number one, they illegally legalized this at a special session of the legislature called for another purpose and kind of slipped it in. Secondly, it's impossible for doctors to accurately predict that patients are going to live 6 months. And third, it didn't give equal protection under the law to people in California. We have all these laws on the books. And for example, if I think a patient is suicidal, I have an obligation to admit them to a psychiatric facility and have them evaluated, and so they won't be a harm to themselves or possibly to others. And but if you have only 6 months to live, well, then I can assist you in actually doing your suicide. There's not equal protection under the law. So this ideology is continuing to spread across the country, legal in Oregon and Washington and Colorado and Vermont and California most recently. And we're seeing the bad effects of it already, including, I remember the pictures in the paper of a lady having her suicide party, inviting all her friends, two-day party on the beach. And then, you know, sunset the second day, they all gathered around. She took her medicine and killed herself. And this glorification of suicide is going to have a tremendous impact on our other people who may be suicidal for other reasons, including my boyfriend broke up with me when I was 18 years old, or my girlfriend.
Mm-hmm. Wow, those states that you just mentioned, they sound like they're on the coast.
They are. Vermont's the only one that's not in Colorado, but the left coast, for example, this has started in Oregon and went to Washington, continues to spread. Last year, there were attempts to legalize it in 35 states across the country. And if it isn't in your state yet, it's coming. And this is all perpetuated by saying this is compassion. We don't want people to suffer, but it's just a flight from compassion. Compassion means coming alongside and helping people bear their burden, not giving them a lethal dose of medication and say, you know, the world's better off without you.
Wow. Yeah, that that makes me pause, David. That's a serious serious predicament we're facing. Anyway, that just kind of knocks me off my place a little bit. That's where we're going.
It is, and you know, and one of the concerns we have, it's so dangerous for the healthcare profession because the doctor-patient relationship is based on trust. People, you know, a woman will come into my practice and tell me the most intimate things about her health and take off her clothes and let me examine her. Why? Because she trusts me. I mean, I have a nurse there, but she knows I'm not going to confide that information to someone else. I'm not going to take sexual advantage of her, that I'm always going to do what's in her best interest. And when a doctor can both kill and cure, you really can't trust the doctor. And that was what happened the days before Hippocrates. Doctors both cured and killed. And Hippocrates said, medicine doesn't work like that. And the foundation of Western medicine is we will do no harm. We will not take your life. We will be alongside. We will keep confidence. And all this is being broken by this insidious thing of physician-assisted suicide, which they have changed into euphemism and call it aid in dying. I mean, I aid people in dying my whole career. That doesn't mean I killed them.
Mm-hmm.
And then where this goes is from this to euthanasia. And then if you're going to do it for suffering because you're terminally ill, why not if you're chronically ill? And if you're not ill at all but have psychiatric disease, why not for that? What if you have Alzheimer's? Once it's based on suffering, and that's what this is based on, where do you draw the line? Suffering is totally subjective,
mm-hmm.
and the patient says whether they're suffering or not. So this is a huge issue. People need to be aware of it. It sounds on the surface, well, you know, we're just trying to help these people. But essentially, it's going to really hurt healthcare. It's going to hurt patients, families, and society.
David, I know this is a big topic of conversation with the shooting in Florida, and I was reading that this young man had antidepressants in his system, some which would produce both suicidal and homicidal tendencies. How much of a problem are these drugs in young kids today?
Well, there are those side effects. And, you know, you take any drug and you're going to read a long list of potential side effects because anything that's ever been reported usually is mentioned, whether it's rare or it's common. And these antidepressant drugs, it's fairly rare, but it can happen. And it may have had an impact. We know this young man had psychiatric problems. And the biggest thing I think we're facing in that whole arena is we had places for these type of patients to get inpatient treatment. And now it's very difficult, if not impossible, for people to find it. I have a physician friend whose daughter had some serious issues, and it took her 4 months to get her into an inpatient psychiatric facility. And she was the head vice president in a huge hospital system. It's just tragic what's happening, especially with young people, but at people of all ages, and the fact that we do not have enough psychiatrists, we do not have enough inpatient facilities and options for people to be taken care of. And what can happen is what happened in Florida, where this young man with obvious issues wasn't identified and confined for treatment.
Mm-hmm. David, we just have a little less than a minute. I want to ask about the World Medical Association now requiring doctors to refer women to abortion.
Yeah, they've got a new policy they're considering. We've spoken out along with the Catholic Medical Association and other groups, essentially saying that physicians have to refer. That means they become morally complicit in abortion by facilitating it. And if they can't find someone to refer to, then they need to do their abortion themselves. And if they don't, they're unethical. We've come a long ways, you know, first to say, allow us to do abortions, then tolerate it and say it's not a bad thing. And now you must participate and actually do them or you could lose your license. And this is a huge issue. And where the World Medical Association is, where often the world goes following in their footsteps. So this is something we're very concerned about and could prevent your listeners from finding a physician who is pro-life because they're going to be forced out of healthcare.
Mm-hmm. David, thank you so much for being a guest on the show. Always look forward to getting your input. Thank you again and have a great day.
Okay, thanks, Bill. God bless.
God bless you. 26 minutes after the hour, let's take a little break and we'll keep it going with Breakpoint. Be back in a minute.
This is your daily dose of devotion. We buy them both and pass the savings on to you. It's the Early Morning Late Show with Bill Arnold on Faith Radio.
It's 31 minutes after the hour. All right. Glad you're with me this morning. We're going to take a little break because we do that now and then on the show. And then we're going to talk to Ron Deal from Family Life Blended. We're going to have a good conversation with him about the prodigal child. Maybe you have one. Maybe you have a question for Ron. You can give us a call at 1-877-933-2484, 877-933-2484. You got maybe a son or daughter that you're struggling with, and you want to ask Ron a question. I bet he's got some good advice. We'll be back in a minute. I got a good line on myself. I let the truth be told. Good morning. 24 minutes until the top of the hour. Bill's tip number one, discipline is a happy word. Just so you know, it's a very happy word. Living simply starts with practicing spiritual discipline. Dr. Philip Nation says it begins with looking at what you love most.
Where is my heart's affection? Where is my mind's attention? Where do I place my affection and my attention? And those are the things I'm going to discipline myself to follow after and chase after. And everything else becomes just this really sad case of idolatry where we're just trying to domesticate deity and just get him conformed to who we are. And that's the problem with legalism. In the end, it's not trying to convince God that we're good enough for him. It really is diminishing God so that he will just bow to our whims and our will. And so we need to first ask the question, where is all of my love placed? What is it that I esteem and I hold in the highest value? And then you let the disciplines chase after.
That was Dr. Philip Nation. And if he wants to stop being a pastor and an author, he's got a great name for being a rapper. How about that? If you want to hear that full interview, go to myfaithradio.com. You can check it out. Take a short break and then be back with Ron Deal. Just a minute.
The teenage years are important ones. They're not just a time to get through as fast as possible, especially when it comes to spiritual things. Hi, I'm Mark Gregston with Parenting Today's Teens. It's easy to wish away the turbulent teen years. But I wish I could show you what they'll look like 20 years from now, when you and your child will fondly remember these days. You'll see that God was doing great things. He was teaching your son or daughter to think, to understand, to trust, and to take risk. He was molding them just as he wanted. And beyond that, he was teaching you to let go and to trust him. These lessons in spiritual growth are too valuable to wish away.
Having trouble parenting your teen in today's rapidly changing culture? Get instant access to Mark's new free parenting course online at freeparentingcourse.com.
Speaking truth into challenging family situations is what Ron Deal does so well. He is my guest from Family Life Blended. Good morning, Ron.
Good morning. How are you today?
I'm good, thanks. Say, I want to talk a little bit about the prodigal child this morning. And I'm curious, why is anger the go-to emotion with kids?
Well, it's because we feel so deeply for them and we're afraid. Really, when I as a parent get angry with my kids, probably what's underneath that is I'm fearful for them in some way. I'm concerned about some choice that they're making. And clearly with a prodigal, right, the fear is they're walking away from God. They're stepping away from their faith. Are they losing their soul? I mean, you know, those kinds of fears is what's heavy on a parent's heart. And for a lot of us, we don't know how to articulate that emotion well. What we do is just articulate it through anger.
Now, Ron, how do we combat anger when we have literally physical reactions?
Well,
our body starts dumping chemicals into our system, and all of a sudden, anger rises to the surface easily.
Exactly. And Bill, listen, you have nailed this. This, I think, is a critical, critical issue when it comes to parents loving a prodigal or friends and family members loving a prodigal. Because if we don't manage our anger, if we don't breathe deep, calm ourselves down, and not respond out of anger, then we risk losing that person altogether. You know, anger communicates rejection. Anger communicates you're unworthy, you're unacceptable. And let me tell you, feeling unacceptable, feeling rejected, that does not ready someone's heart for change. Love is what readies somebody's heart for change. So we take a great risk if we don't manage our anger well. Here's what I would suggest to you, just on a very practical sense. In Psalms, David one of the Psalms is a song of ascent. He's on his way to worship God. And it's interesting what he says he does to prepare himself to step into the temple and worship God. He said, I calmed my soul. I, like a weaned child, I calmed my soul so that I could walk in. You know, and I think about that and I think, yeah, a child who's not weaned needs somebody else to calm it down. It needs mom to come alongside it to calm. It can't do that all by itself. It cannot self-regulate. It needs somebody else to regulate it. And a lot of us as adults, to be honest, as parents, we're the same way. When we get upset, we get worried about our kids, which of course we're going to feel, that we lose ourselves. We become like a little baby who cannot manage and regulate itself. We need somebody else to do that. And who is the somebody else? Our prodigal. It's as if we're saying to our kid, look, I need you to straighten up so I can feel better. Well, that's not, you know, that's a lousy way of bringing influence to your child, right? No, you're the one who has to manage you. You have to calm your own soul so that you can respond out of love, so that you can articulate your concerns in a calm way that can be heard by the other person, not make them feel rejected.
Ron, but if we're getting angry, aren't we sending the message that we're doing something about this problem?
Yeah, and see, that's the thing. We do want to do something about it, right? I mean, clearly the concerns are legitimate, and that's the important thing, is that there's good reason to be worried about this other person. But we just have to recognize that how we express that worry either helps or hurts. And you have to ask yourself the question, are you really doing something about it if you're just being angry? Mm-hmm. Are you really doing something that's helpful? Well, you're doing something, but I would contend that it's not helpful. And 9 times out of 10, it just makes things worse, not better.
It's difficult to express our emotions, though. And it's hard to say, gosh, your behavior is making me sad.
Mm-hmm.
Would that
yes.
be a wise thing or a dumb thing to say?
No, I think that's honest. You know, to say, look, I love you and I care for you. I want good things for you, which is why this concerns me, which is why I'm worried about where your life is headed. Now, I just want you to know I still love you. I still care for you, which is why I'm worried for you, right? It's my love that's motivating my worry on your behalf. But listen to my tone. My tone is communicating affection, love, compassion, desire, hopefulness. Like, I'm here. I'm coming alongside you in this thing. I'm not against you. We're not in war right now. I'm on your team. That's the message of connection and care and concern. Anger communicates it's you versus me. You better do it my way. Now we're getting into control. And let me just tell you, oftentimes, if we backed up a few steps, that control anger thing from a parent is one of the reasons the child is rebelling. Not always. I'm not blaming the parent here. I'm just saying that has not helped in the past. And again, getting angry in the present is not going to make things any better.
Mm-hmm. So we also have to be reminding ourselves that we are modeling behavior. And anything that we are wanting our kids to do or not to do is going to be seen in whatever we do or not do.
Yeah. You know, let's look at Jesus for a minute. Great case studies. There were times and occasions where Jesus got angry with people, but that was always when people were in pride, who were arrogantly standing against the kingdom, and they were closed, and they were hypocritical, and they were closed to truth. And there was a reason Jesus got angry. It was often because they were hurting other people and offending other people, and he was standing up for the disenfranchised and the people who were being hurt by the arrogant folks. But you see Jesus over and over again coming alongside sinners all the time. You know, I love the quote from Rosaria Butterfield, who says, Jesus ate with sinners. He didn't sin with sinners.
Mm-hmm.
And I think sometimes we as parents wrestling with a prodigal are fearful that eating with the sinner is somehow condoning or blessing their behavior, sending the wrong. Well, but no, that's exactly wrong. Eating with them is how you gain influence. You're not sinning alongside them. You're not joining them in that behavior. You're coming alongside them and sitting down and being near, which is how you gain influence. Jesus did that over and over and over with people. Closeness is what fosters communication, what fosters influence in our ability to then perhaps speak into their lives. When we pull away in anger, you know, that's another thing parents do that we think somehow is helpful. I'm going to reject you. I'm going to distance myself from you so that you will want to come and join me in my values. Like, when you say it out loud, you just realize how futile that is.
Yeah, I'm just curious as to how adults can process some of their own anger, though, if they're feeling that way, instead of taking it out on the prodigal. What, do you scream into a pillow, or do you take the dog out for a walk even if you don't have a dog?
You do, and you talk to your spouse, and you talk to your friends, and you talk to your pastor, and you articulate that angst, and you get it out, because that is a very real thing for you. But you don't take that angst out on the child or on the prodigal.
Gotcha. All right, Ron, let me take a break. If you have a question for Ron Deal, give us a call if you've got a prodigal child and you would like to ask Ron a question. We'll take a question or two. 877-933-2484 is the number, or you can email me, bill@myfaithradio.com, and I can ask your question anonymously. There we go. We'll take a break. Be right back. It's 11 minutes till the top of the hour. Caller already said, Bill, can you really not say the word anonymously? I can. I was just messing around. Ron Deal is my guest from Family Life Blended. We're talking about the prodigal son or daughter. If you've got a prodigal child, you'd still like to give us a call, we'll take a question. 877-933-2484. 877-933-2484. Ron, what's one thing we should not do with a prodigal child?
Well, we've talked about withdrawing in anger or communicating rejection. We've talked about moving away from them in terms of emotionally distancing yourself. You know, that's kind of boycotting their world and their life and saying, well, fine, if you're going to live that way, then you can't have anything to do with us. You know, both of those, again, fall flat. You're not increasing your influence. You are decreasing your influence. And those are things that we should really think about. Here's one of the other delicate ones, Bill, and I think we have to ask this question. And people ask, what should I attend the wedding if it's something I don't approve of? Mm-hmm. Should I be in their home if they're living a lifestyle that we don't approve of? If their behavior is somehow showing their lack of faith, do we come alongside them and join them in how they live life? There's a lot of delicate things there, and I don't think there's a black and white answer that yes, you should go, or no, you should not go. I think there's things that people have to consider, and there's reasons why you might say yes or no. But let me just talk around this for a minute. The one thing I think you don't do is you don't just make a blanket statement of no, I can't ever engage with them on any level because they're living this sort of lifestyle. That sort of blanket response means you're not being discerning. And again, what you're probably doing is just distancing yourself, stepping away, thinking that that will somehow help motivate the person toward your point of view. I think what we have to do is sometimes come alongside them, but we could define what we're doing. You can say to somebody, you know, you know that I love you and I care for you. And because of that, I can't condone this part of your life. However, I am going to come to your, you know, get together in your home this coming Saturday, and I'll be happy to be there. And just want you to know that it's because we care and love for you, right? So what you've said in that one statement is, no, I don't condone this part of your life, but yes, I love and accept you. That kind of double message is uncomfortable sometimes for us as Christians. We feel like we're talking out of both sides of our mouth. But I really think that that's the heart of what Jesus communicated to people. He knew that they were deceived. He knew that they were blinded to their own behavior. And so, again, he ate with sinners, but he didn't sin with sinners. So he found a way, and I think this is what behooves us. We get to find a way to be with the person we're trying to influence. And at the same time, we can speak truth about the pieces of their life that we don't approve of.
Mm-hmm. So, Ron, what happens when the shoe is on the other foot and the person that we're talking to turns around and says, I see you as judgmental and unloving, and I think you're a hater.
Yeah. Well, I think we could say, well, tell me more about that. Tell me what it is that you're feeling based on how I'm responding or reacting. Now, notice what I did there. Immediately, I asked a question and started listening rather than defending or arguing. Now, that's not a subtle thing. That is a very important move strategically in a dialogue, because what I'm saying to the person is, all right, I'll listen to you. I'll hear you. I will be influenced by you, which, by the way, invites them to turn around and be a little softer when it comes time for them to listen to you, right? But it also gives you time to think and to process and to hear more specifically what it is that they have an issue with. And sometimes it's a matter of they misunderstand something, or sometimes they're making an assumption about, well, because you said this, then you're like all the other people who say that, and you're a hater. And it gives you an opportunity to say, I could see how you'd feel that way. I mean, because there certainly are people, and there certainly are Christians who stand in judgment and just kind of, you know, and I get it, and I don't want to be one of those persons. Let me share a little bit more deeply with you why I said what I said. And so you begin to talk around, well, that's an issue, that's a value, or here's a scripture that speaks to that. But again, your heart is, I am for you. As long as you are communicating to the person, I'm for you, not against you, then all of a sudden I think that softens the dialogue. I think it opens the door for them to feel like you may have their best interests at heart, even though you disagree on an issue. And at the end of the day, Bill, that's how we gain influence in this person's life.
Ron, let's jump back to the prodigal child. They are pushing you to the very end of your rope, and then you say to them, I'm for you, when I know you are, as a parent, you're for them, but they're killing you. Then what?
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm not saying you can't ever say at some point to somebody, of course I love you, but I just have to say, I can't do this. I can't support that. I can't come alongside you here. I want better things for you, and I just don't think this is the best way. Now, I think privately at that point, and by the way, maybe this whole time, your prayer to God on behalf of the prodigal, and this is going to sound horrible on the surface, so let me explain. Sometimes we have to pray misery over people we love. And what I mean by that is that they will come to see the end of the road that they're on, that they'll see and maybe feel the consequence of that. It's, you know, it has no goal. There's no, it's pointless. It goes nowhere. And sometimes misery, if you will, sadness or heartache or pain is the thing that makes people stop and consider the path that they're on. Now, I would never, ever really want them to be miserable. But if that's the thing that turns them around.
Yeah, that's scary
so
praying, isn't it?
That is very scary praying. I mean, I have prayed that on behalf of people that I love and care for. And I always kind of qualify it. I say, God, I'm praying misery. Just don't make it too miserable. I mean, you know, you know, it's at the same time I'm saying it, I feel really like I don't want it to be very painful for them. Just enough. Just enough. It's the story of the prodigal son. You know, he's eating the pig slop. And that's his misery.
Right.
That's what changes his heart, opens his mind to, wait a minute, what am I doing? Right? Yeah. He came to his senses because of the misery. And that's what we got to pray sometimes for people we love. I wouldn't necessarily say that to their face.
Yeah.
But pray. But that, it is something I could pray.
But pray that circumstances come into their life that gets their attention. I think that's what
that's
we're saying.
Right.
Yeah. Ron,
that's
always
right.
A pleasure. Thanks for being on the show. And I look forward to our next conversation.
Thanks, Bill.
You're
good
the
to
best.
Be with you.
Thanks, Ron. It is 4 minutes till the top of the hour. We'll take a very short break and wrap up the show. Thank you very much to Ron Deal and also all my guests today. What a great show it was. It's nice to be, it's nice to have so many smart people on the show, because I'm not that smart. So it's really nice to have smart people on. Anyway, speaking of smart, Lakers rookie Lonzo Ball, if you call this smart, is charging $199 for his autograph. About 300 people apparently showed up at the Los Angeles area mall Saturday looking for his first official signing. He's only averaging 10 points a game and charging $200 for an autograph. smart? I'm not so sure that's smart. Anyway, have a great day, everyone. We'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to the Early Morning Late Show podcast. These conversations are available because of your prayerful and financial support. Make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of the Early Morning Late Show, subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and grow the impact of the Early Morning Late Show. Connecting.